welcome to episode 7 of Kid You Not,
the podcast on children's literature. I'm Lauren Davis.
And I'm Clementine Beauvais. Today we're going to be discussing something a little lighter than usual.
Really, Clem? Really? This is exactly the attitude that makes it hard for these books to succeed.
What?
Funny books rarely get taken seriously by critics, as it's presumed that if a book is funny, it can't be serious.
Okay, well, at least we're discussing something more cheerful than previous episodes. We're talking about humour in children's books.
Which means that some of my favourite books can come out to play.
Yay! Finally. Well, Lauren, if that's one of your favourite books that you're going to be reading today, just start.
Dad had Uncle Eddie round so naturally, they had to come and nose around and see what I was up to. If Uncle Eddie, who was as bold as a coot, two coots in fact, says to me one more time, "Should bald heads be buttered?" I may kill myself. He doesn't seem to realise that I no longer wear romper suits. I feel like yelling at him, "I am 14 years old, Uncle Eddie! I am bursting with womanhood! I wear a bra!" Okay, it sits a bit on the loose side and does ride up round my neck if I run for the bus, but the womanly potential is there, you bald coot! Talking of breasts, I'm worried that I may end up like the rest of the women in my family, with just the one bust, like a sort of shelf affair. Mum can balance things on hers when her hands are full. At parties and so on, she can have a sandwich and a drink and save a snack for later by putting it on her shelf. It's very unattractive. I would like a proper amount of breastiness, but not go too far with it. Like Melanie Andrews, for instance. I got the most awful shock in the showers after hockey last term. Her bra looks like two shopping bags. I suspect she is a bit unbalanced hormonally. She certainly is when she tries to run for the ball. I thought she'd run right through the fence with the momentum of her bosomers, as Jazz so amusingly calls them.
And that was an extract from
my all-time favourite teenage read, Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging.
And I'd like to point out that it was also one of my favourite books when I was a teenager. So we are going to be talking about funny books for children, and is it fair to say, Lauren, that funny books sell incredibly well and in fact better than any sort of children's books?
Not better than any sort. I mean, Twilight and Harry Potter are
That's true. The
best-selling things of all time. And
pretty funny, though. I mean, a sparkly vampire.
Yeah, that's a different sort of humour, isn't it? We're laughing at them, not with them in that case. But I suppose the current bestseller is definitely humorous.
Yes. And can you guess what it is yet? If not, you haven't been following the news.
Not at all.
So what is it?
It's Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which we also love, by the way.
Yes, Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Is this a good place to start our discussion? Because I think Diary of a Wimpy Kid is a pretty good example of what a perfect funny book for kids is about.
Perfect?
Well, in terms of it's got all the characteristics that make a funny book for children. It's got sort of everyday high school life, which we heard about a little bit in Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging. It's got, you know, the cartoons. You know, cartoons by definition are like the funny side of illustration. And it's got the language, all the situational humour, all the language humour, pathetic character who's constantly bullied but at the same time quite friendly. I mean, it's a pretty good example of a funny book, and it's easy to understand why it sells so well.
For anyone that hasn't read Diary of a Wimpy Kid, the premise is fairly simple. Protagonist Greg Heffley is trying to survive middle school, and the book is his diary with a few cartoons that he's drawn in it. As Clem says, probably the thing that makes it so funny is that he is deeply flawed. He is not an entirely sympathetic protagonist, and a lot of the plots revolve around him trying to humiliate his friends or get one over on his friends to climb further up the school popularity ladder.
Yes, and I think Jeff Kinney, is that his name? Jeff Kinney said in an interview that I read recently that the reason why the books are so immensely popular, they're American by the way, popular around the world, is that everyone's been to high school and everyone has sort of felt the peer pressure. And I think that's a pretty good ingredient for humour, isn't it? Something that everyone can relate to and sort of look at their own experience with the humorous distance to de-dramatise it and make fun of, yes, the protagonist, but also perhaps themselves.
Yes, because he's definitely picked a time in most people's lives when they were deeply insecure and painfully conscious of what other people thought of them. So I suppose for adults and children, yeah, there's a lot of recognition in there, which a lot of comedians say that is the source of their humour, when yeah, people recognise themselves or people they know in certain situations.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, a common characteristic of humour, of course, is that humour is about the everyday life and about what makes human beings appear sort of not at their advantage. Whereas in the sort of fiction that we're discussing, that we've been discussing so far, so, you know, Twilight, Harry Potter, Philip Pullman, etc., that's the contrary. It would be, you know, everything that's heroic and high and everything. But really, in funny books for children, we're taken back to the weaknesses and all the funny faults that people have. And I think that's something that children can relate to quite easily.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember, though, that these aspects of humour are common to all humour. That's what a lot of adult sitcoms books are based on, the worst, people's worst version of themselves rather than the best.
Yeah, but that, it seems, it's funny that children's books seem to obey exactly the same kind of rule. We very often have characters who are put in situations where they are made to feel sort of awkward or humiliated, or I think it, to a very large extent, it's all about de-dramatising.
And it's difficult to think of comic heroes that don't have significant flaws, isn't it? Like in Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Stalking, Georgia Nicholson is your typical teenager in that she's obsessed with herself and her looks and a little bit selfish, mean to her friends.
But that, what was quite funny is that although she is, and although, you know, Greg in Diary of a Wimpy Kid is that as well, you would think, you know, maybe that would be a reason for children and teenagers not to like these heroes because they would see too much of their own flaws in them. Whereas actually it's exactly the opposite. It seems that children really relish these portrayal of indirectly themselves and in all their flaws. They like all their heroes and they like all their heroics, but also they like finding their own weaknesses in comic heroes. I mean, I loved Georgia Nicholson's Diary, and, you know, I know that if I was still in middle school, I would love Diary of a Wimpy Kid because it would remind me of myself.
Yeah. So that brings us on nicely to, shall we call them age sensitivities in children's books? Because you often hear adults say, oh no, the jokes are too old for someone. They don't necessarily, they could mean too sophisticated, too rude, or, you know, just above
too clever.
Yeah, too clever, above the comprehension of children. And something that I find fascinating, and perhaps says far more about adults than children, is that when a text is found amusing by adults and children, adults often say, well, it's more for adults, really, isn't it? For example, my dad took my, God, what's she been then 7-year-old sister to see Fantastic Mr. Fox at the cinema. And when he came out, he said, oh, that was really good. Much more of an adult's film than a kid's film, though. Lucy was laughing along. I didn't really understand how she got the jokes. And instead of recognising that maybe some humour is just universal, and adults and children could find the same things funny, instead, Lucy, my sister, was recognising adult jokes, not just jokes. And it's often said about Shrek, isn't it?
Yeah.
That, oh, that's not really a children's film.
When all the kids love it. That's the thing. I mean, if there's one kind of critic who will never lie about liking or disliking something, it's a child, by definition. If they don't find it funny, they're not going to force themselves to laugh. It's, I mean, it goes back to what we said about adults' book and children's books. That very often, when adults like a book, they're going to say, oh, but it really is an adult's book that's sort of parading off as a children's book. Because, you know, as an adult, you want to sort of expel from your anything that can be, you know, called childish taste. And I think that's the same. If it's humour that you understand, then you're going to try and say, well, that's because it's adult humour and clearly children are not understanding it very well. And I think, I mean, really, I think publishing is very often guilty of that, of finding that, you know, books are too clever or too intelligent in terms of humour and therefore it can't be for children. But really, I find that so infuriating because I perfectly remember, and here, I mean, we can say whatever we want about remembering childhood reading and having a completely wrong view of it, completely wrong memories of it, but there is, you know, my parents can testify that I would laugh my head off reading Jennings by Anthony Buckridge, reading Asterix, reading Little Nicholas, all of these books that really, I'm sure there are some jokes that I did not understand, but most of the joke I did understand. And these books are frequently quoted in France as being adult humor that is sort of given to children and passing off as a children's book. But I remember laughing at them.
Perhaps it just says something about how the concepts or the constructs of adulthood and childhood have been constructed. Childhood is by definition a less sophisticated state, so the humour that adults recognise, therefore, you know, how can children recognise that? And if they do, they're clearly just quite advanced and...
Oh yeah, I mean, obviously you're a child prodigy if you can understand verbal humour. It's something that really bothers me, because I think that very often we don't think that children... We underestimate children's abilities to understand humour. That said, of course, under a certain age, I mean, I think it's difficult to deny that children cannot understand humour. I mean, I love being with a toddler who's about 2 or 3 years old, because they don't understand jokes at all, so you make jokes, and they just look at you looking completely baffled. But really, as children's reading develops and as children's abilities to understand books develop, I think they actually acquire a sense of humour extremely rapidly. Although, should we talk a little bit about the different types of humour that we encounter in children's books? Because humour is a very big, all-encompassing term, but there are different types of it.
My favourite was always verbal humour.
Mm-hmm. And that's the one that very often adults think children don't understand.
Yeah, that always annoys me, because that was always my favourite type of humour as a child. What was often assumed to be the humour that I should like, which I really didn't, was... What can we call it? Gross-out humour.
Yes, that's right. Humour about poo, humour about...
Toilet humour.
Yeah, that's right. The number of books about underwear, the number of books about going to the toilet, the number of books... I mean, you know, I'm sure that there is a picture book somewhere called How Do Robots Go to the Toilet? Like, it's seen as the gold mine.
Oh, what's that? The mole who knew that it was none of his business.
Yeah, that's right.
I did not enjoy that book.
Yeah, it's all that is based on the idea that children will laugh about the most basic functions of the human body.
And obviously, a lot of children do
laugh. Oh, yeah.
Children, the functions of the human body. And it's entirely acceptable. We are not trying to infer the reason.
No.
Just that there's lots of different types of humour.
But about the whole, like, poo humour, I think there is also a dimension to it that, you know, we can acknowledge as being quite useful, is that because these are subjects that make people uncomfortable, that are a little bit taboo in society, not completely, you know, it's not like sex, etc., but I think there is something quite jubilatory for children being able to laugh about it, because it de-dramatises it a little bit. So I think it does have a bit of cathartic effect on children, and that's, they also enjoy the subversiveness of it and the whole transgression dimension of laughing about these functions, because they're, you know, they're a bit, in society, they're not completely acceptable. So it does perform a very particular, a very specific function, which verbal humour does not fulfil, but verbal humour will fulfil another type of function, which is maybe playfulness with language and ability to construct oneself as a speaking being within a community.
Could we argue that the subversive nature of this humour then is therefore empowering for children?
Yeah, I think in humour in general, humour is empowering to a degree. I think all sorts of humour can have a very strong subversive potential. Other types of humour, of course, and more problematic ones, and I'd say maybe these ones are the ones that would be the most problematic from an adult's point of view to accept that children might understand them, would be irony and parody. For different reasons. So irony is when you say something, but you know that you mean something else, but you say it in a way that the other person will understand that you mean something else than what you're saying. That's the definition of irony. And typically, young children do not understand it and find it are completely baffled by it because it goes against, you know, their normal use of language. And it's very often said that in children's books, actually, irony will be misunderstood, and even quite tragically so. Dark humor will not be understood because you know, they will perceive the first level of humor. Well, one example of a book that plays on irony, and a picture book for very young children, for people of all ages, but, you know, I read it, for example, as a very young child, is Haunted House by Jan Pieckowski. I can never say that name. Jan Pieckowski, which is a pop-up book, which is very famous, quite old now. I think it was published in the 70s. And the point of this book is that you visit a house which is actually haunted, and on every page there are the most terrifying monsters, but the voice who is introducing them to you, so the verbal text, will say things like, "My house is very quiet, I don't have guests very often, this is a very my very nice bedroom," and obviously every time the images say exactly the contrary. And that's something that we find very often in picture books, an ironic distance between the text and the images.
Did you have a problem picking up on that as a child?
I don't think so. I don't remember it very clearly because I must have been very, very young when I was first read to, And maybe that's also part of the thing. Maybe as a parent, if you're reading a picture book like that to your child, you're going to say, "Oh, is it right then? Is what he's saying really right? Because look at the picture, what's happening there?" So you might help the child understand the irony. But it doesn't mean that after one reading, the child is not going to pick up on the fact that it's supposed to be funny, that there is this distance between the text and the image.
And what about parody? Because people often say that kids can't understand parody if they don't have never experienced what the text is or character is a parody of.
Well, I think that's valid for everyone. A parody by definition, you know, if adults haven't read the text before. I think parody, there is something probably quite valid in people's worry that children will not understand parodies because they have had a much shorter span of life to encounter the reference that is going to be parodied. Recently, we studied at the book group at Cambridge, The Willoughbys by Lois Lowry, who is a fantastic writer, and The Willoughbys is a very funny book, which is extremely metafictional, intertextual, and a parody of a lot of classics of children's literature, you know, such as Little Women, such as all the Frances Hodgson, I can never say that books, etc. And The Willoughbys, a lot of people expressed concerns at the book group that children would not understand why it's funny because they haven't read the basic text. And I think it's a fairly valid thing to be worried about, even though there is enough humour in the rest of the book that is not part of the parody, to still find it funny. Now, maybe children will not find it, children and people who didn't read the original text will not find some passages of it funny. It doesn't mean that they won't enjoy the whole book.
Yeah, because not everyone likes every joke that a comedian says or that is in a book, and it's not expected that you'll like or even get every joke, because as we've said, humour involves many points of reference. Even gross out humour requires the knowledge or sense that something that's usually hidden and taboo and considered a bit gross is being discussed. So, yeah, is it really so problematic if children don't understand every single joke? If there is a parody or an ironic statement that they don't understand, does it become such a problem if there's lots of other things that they do pick up on and value and return to?
Exactly. I think I would say it's really not a problem. And we have quite a good recent example of that. It's David Walliams. I don't know what you think, but I think that David Walliams' books are maybe 50-50. 50% children's humour and 50% adult humour, in the sense that there are some references that children definitely will not get in David Walliams' books. David Walliams is, for our non-British listeners, a very famous comedian in Britain, and I'm tempted to be a bit cynical there and say that that's probably why a book that has so much adult humour in it was published in the first place. They're all excellent books, so we can quote, for example, The Boy in the Dress.
That's my favourite one.
Mr. Stink, Billionaire Boy, and quite recently Gangster Granny. But children love them too, because it doesn't matter if there are twice a page there's a joke that they're not going to get, because next to that there's enough humour that they will get in order for them to like it, and vice versa for adults.
And I suppose an important point is, depending on what sort of reader they are, if a children like a book, they will return to it
yes.
in years to come, and in future readings will understand the jokes they didn't pick up on before, and in fact it therefore creates a more enjoyable reading experience for them, because their reading of the text changes as their experience grows.
Yeah, I mean, I have a personal anecdote with that. When I was little, I read a lot of the Asterix books, and one of them is Asterix in Britain, and a lot of the humour in Asterix in Britain is based on making fun of British people. And one of the things that all the British people in Asterix in Britain do is start all their sentences by saying, I say. But since the book is in French, it starts in French by the first, the two words for I say, which is je dis, and then a whole sentence. When I was little, I had no idea why the hell they all started their sentences like that. And it's only much, 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 much later when I started learning English that I realised that actually a frequent conception of British people is that they always start their sentences with I say. That's something that I never understood as a kid, but I like the oddness of it. I like the bizarre way of starting sentences, and it didn't bother me that much. I didn't know why, what it was parodying.
So that leads us nicely on to that humour doesn't always transcend cultures, does it? A pragmatic point about funny books or humorous titles is that they can be more difficult for foreign rights departments in publishers to sell, because humour is often a very cultural thing, and funny books would therefore require more than a straight translation in order to make them work for audiences of a different native language. The absolute love, as you may have guessed, of my teenagers, Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging, I always think of it as very, very British. Loads of the things in it are really, really English. The vocabulary, the plot, the situation, the narrative voice. Very, very English. And I always found it hilarious that the American edition of the book had to have a glossary printed with it so that the people across the pond would not misread sentences such as, Alison Bummer lit up a fag. Because a fag in England is something very different to a fag in America. And I always found that hilarious. Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging is a very light read. It strikes me as very odd that you would pick up something light that would need a glossary that you would need to refer to constantly.
And by definition, that's not humour. If you need an extra step to understand the humour, by definition, if someone tells you a joke that you don't understand and explains the joke, it's not as funny, is it?
Exactly. The second book, lots of the books had to have their titles changed because they just didn't work in US vernacular. So the title of the second book, It's Okay, I'm Wearing Really Big Knickers, had to be changed to On the Bright Side, I'm Now the Girlfriend of a Sex God, as our US friends don't use the word knickers and aren't really sure what they are. Needless to say, I prefer our British title, and to me, it seems to water down a lot of the humour. But when I was pointing this out to Clementine earlier in about how English the books are, she read the original in French as a teenager, and I found that really weird.
Yeah, but I think, okay, so first of all, there is something about Anglo-Saxon cultural imperialism in the whole world, which means that the whole world understands British and American humour, whilst British and American people do not understand the rest of the world's humour.
I didn't say that you had to understand humour. I just said there were some jokes I didn't understand how they could be translated.
So they're not translated. Well, most of the time, these jokes, so I read all of them, of the Louise Renison books. I love them. I read and reread them and reread them. And I knew, of course, that the original language was not French, but that's something that happens quite frequently for the rest of the world. And they transpose the joke. So that's how humor does not get translated. Humor gets transposed. That's really what's happening. I think more than any type of book, the funny book gets transposed into other cultures. So in the Louise Renison books, some of the jokes are directly translated, so without any change. So for example, you know, she will talk about someone who's anorexic, who's someone who's got a terrible anorak and who is very, very skinny. You know, that's not a problem. You can translate it in French. It works perfectly well, no problem. But then some of the jokes obviously rely on cultural knowledge that a French person would never, ever have.
And these books are full of cultural references. Mm. So again, near the start of the book, there's a joke where the narrator says, "I don't see why I can't have a lock on my bedroom door. I have no privacy. It's like Noel's house party in my room."
Yeah, and this joke is completely lost on me because even having lived 6 years in the UK, I have no idea what this refers to. But I clearly remember that in the French version, this is translated, I think, by "my bedroom is like the garden wall." So here you get the transposed joke, which, yeah, I very clearly remember laughing at this joke. And actually, I remember it so well that it's probably something that I've reused since.
But it's funny because I said to Clementine, "Oh, but you've lost something really crucial about the joke in that translation." In other words, the naffness of Noel's house party, because it's a TV show from when I was about 8, so God, 15 years ago at least. Incredibly, incredibly naff, and just involved Noel Edmonds in this big on-set house who had a series of quite strange visitors. So the joke, which again, if I'm having to explain it, it's clearly not funny, is it, Clem? With of constant, a little bit mental people turning up in her room. That connotation is lost in the garden.
Yeah, but the thing, I mean, the way, we can have an episode on translation that would be interesting, but the thing is, the way humour gets translated, it's never going to be the same if it's a cultural reference. So what you have to do is find something that is going to be funny, if in a different way. And I think, as well, translators who manage to translate funny books and make them funny, I think that is possibly the highest feat of translation, especially if you're doing that for children. I mean, really, people who translate funny books for children, they would need to be awarded a special medal. The important thing is to find a good equivalent, which you will gain something in the process. You won't lose something. You will gain something because you've made it accessible to that audience. That said, though, I do think that there are some books that cannot be translated. Funny books that cannot be translated. Especially funny books that depend on rhymes. You know, once you get into poems for children, The Gruffalo, you know, doesn't really take off all of these. But humour is actually, you know, quite resilient in translation, I would say. But also, I mean, when you think of the number of foreign books that are translated into English, there are very few, but quite a lot of them are funny books. I mean, when you think of, Asterix I've already mentioned, the Tintin books are actually quite funny. Not many people would necessarily qualify them as funny books to start with, but they have a lot of humour. Pippi Longstocking, of course. These are funny books. Young Nicholas as well, which I was mentioning earlier. These are all funny books. So, you know, even for the British and American market, I would say that there is a market for foreign books that are humorous.
So, considering you've just reeled off a whole list of things that have sold very well, shall we discuss that allegation that funny books are often not taken as seriously? Michael Rosen said in an interview with The Telegraph in 2008 that he set up the Roald Dahl Funny Prize to reward authors and books whose work was never going to be taken seriously by mainstream book awards purely because it's funny. Because there is something about humour that seems to indicate that if the book or the text is therefore less worthy than more literary examples.
Yes, I think one of the reasons why light books, as in humorous books, are not taken seriously is, once again, it's always the same thing, isn't it? Because they're easier to read, because they will, by definition, garner a wider audience than more demanding books.
They don't challenge the readers in the same way.
Some of them, I mean, that's definitely what people think, but I think that some of them really do.
No, I agree with you. I mean, that's a common misconception about funny books. If it's funny, it can't be stimulating, literary, challenging, or any of those things.
So, that said, though, from the point of view of children's literature criticism, the body of scholarship on Pippi Longstocking in Scandinavian countries is astonishing. It really is wonderful to see that Pippi Longstocking, which is really very light and very funny, I remember laughing my head off reading Pippi Longstocking when I was little, the body of academic work on the subject is extremely impressive. And it is a funny book that is taken seriously. And what is generally said about Pippi Longstocking is that it is one of the very, very few children's books that truly, as we said earlier, challenge authority. Are you in favor of a world where children are able to challenge authority on lots of different levels and challenge conventions? So this is an example of a book, a classic, which, despite its status as a funny book, has, you know, is actually garners a lot of respect from a lot of different people. So, you know, maybe things are not as bad as they look, and maybe once a book has acquired the status of a classic, people start wondering what it is in the humour that might, you know, lead to some deeper reflection about the human condition.
So that seems like a good place to leave it. Now we have got on to quite deep matters.
About light humour.
About the human condition.
About the human condition.
In Pippi Longstocking.
Yes! Okay, well, we hope that you enjoyed this episode. Sorry we didn't put lots of jokes in it, but if you want to laugh, you should go and read the books that we've mentioned, because they're extremely funny.
Yeah, if you are a woman, I'm afraid, sorry, Clementine, this is a sexist statement.
Oh dear. I'm not listening.
If you are a woman and have not read Angus Long's Before Frontal Snogging, strongly recommend you to, because it is very good. It will remind you very much of your teenage years. Not so much if you're a bloke. I don't think you used to follow girls round from the neighbouring school, right? And hide behind bins.
Well, maybe you did. but then you're a weirdo. Okay, so next episode will be on one of Lauren's favourite topics, which I think she's wanted to discuss for a long time. So I'll let you say it.
Non-fiction. Very interesting topic.
Yes. Don't start yawning, because really it is a fascinating topic and we'll discuss it at length.
Not least due to people's perception of non-fiction and the huge variety.
And you know how much we like to rehabilitate forgotten genres of children's literature. So see you next time for an episode on nonfiction. In the meantime, go to our website, kidyounotpodcast.com.
Or subscribe to us on iTunes.
Yeah, or email us at kidyounotpodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next month.
Yes. Bye.